from the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC. This is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, the Hollywood sign is a Los Angeles icon, but does it really deserve its own tramway? And Bill Rausch, the artistic director of the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, explains why all art is political.
If you say, I'm going to create this work of art and this is the political impact it's going to have on the world, that's naive. But I think it's even more naive if you don't recognize that whatever you do as an artist will have political impact.
And Armenian-American musicians are adding some fresh flavor to traditional Armenian sounds. All that coming right up. Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. The Hollywood sign is, to the dismay of a lot of its neighbors, a destination for tourists who want to take selfies under the famous landmark. Now, there's a plan in the works to help bring visitors to the sign that wouldn't involve their clogging city streets and hogging parking spots. It's a tramway, and it would carry people about a mile from the Warner Brothers lot up the side of Mount Lee to the sign, where there would be a visitor center and selfie station. Ryan Fonder wrote about the proposed $100 million tramway in the LA Times. And when I spoke with him, we started with the specifics behind the Warner Brothers plan.
So what the Warner Brothers people in the facilities department have proposed doing is creating a sort of gondola system, basically an aerial tramway, to use their words, to take people up there very close to the sign so that people can actually get a good view of it without disrupting the locals.
And the idea, too, is that it would initiate from some part of the Warner Brothers lot. And the Warner Brothers lot is kind of interesting in the way it kind of wraps itself around the 134 freeway in Burbank. Would this be closer to the actual hillside, or would it span across the 134 freeway?
Warner Brothers has a parking lot that they own off of Forest Lawn Drive. And what it would do is, you know, that's very adjacent to the lot. It's where they stage a lot of the talk shows and sitcoms. And what this would do is it would take people onto the tram from that parking lot up to a staging area very close to the sign.
Is the idea, too, that the tram will take people to the base of the Hollywood sign where they'll take pictures? Will there be some sort of museum or attraction? What's the conceit of what you do once you get there?
They will have a area that they're calling an educational center, which is sort of like a visitor center that'll talk about how the park is an important environmental fixture and some of the history of the sign. And from there, they'll take a very short pathway to an outdoor staging area where they can actually take a view and take pictures and all that.
It is the idea that this would be a benefit for Warner Brothers in terms of its studio tour. How does the studio itself benefit?
Well, they've been building out their backlot tour for a long time. It's unclear how this would actually funnel people into Warner Brothers' larger business. I don't think that's been quite articulated or ironed out yet. But it's pretty clear that Warner Brothers wants to be more a part of the tourism industry. This would be a part of that. I don't think you'll see, you know, very much Warner Brothers branding on these aerial trams, but you know, it'll get people close to the lot, that's for sure.
What are the residents' reaction? Because obviously when you live anywhere near the Hollywood sign, you know that part of that neighborhood is going to be visited by a lot of tourists. Do they have mixed feelings, or do they think this is the best solution to maybe a bad problem?
From the people that I talked to, the residents hope that this will alleviate some of the problem. There's a little bit of skepticism that people will actually go out of their way to go to the Burbank lot and pay to ride a tram up there when they're used to just kind of roaming the Hollywood Hills and finding a good way to take a snapshot of the sign on their own. And there's also concerns that this will lead to even more tourists. And then there's also the environmental issues, too.
The environmental issues of building a tram over an urban park, Griffith Park?
Exactly. Anytime you build something in the park, you're going to have to go through a very extensive environmental review process. And that's going to be one of the reasons why we're not going to see this for at least 5 years, if it happens at all.
Is it possible that other companies will try to propose similar ideas? Because Universal Studios is not far from there. They have almost as good an angle to the Hollywood sign as Warner Brothers might have. Are there other people bidding for this idea?
Definitely. There's already a group led by Alex von Furstenberg, who's the son of the fashion mogul Diane von Furstenberg. And they would build, they have a similar proposal in the works, but it's not clear where exactly they would start from or how much it would cost.
Is there the possibility that if this gondola goes through, L.A. could be dotted with gondolas that are taking visitors to people like the Santa Monica Pier or Beverly Hills? I mean, is this a one-off or is this maybe a glimpse into the future of selfie tourism?
It seems like this is having a moment right now. Just earlier this year, a private company proposed building a gondola that would take people from Union Station all the way up to Dodger Stadium. So this is an idea that is not necessarily new. People have been talking about building gondolas through LA since the 60s.
Tourism is obviously a huge component of the Southern California economy. Does this fit into kind of the future, the next wave of tourism in the region? And are people who are responsible for bringing tourists to the area excited about what this might mean in terms of spillover and other tourists coming and spending more time in the city?
Yeah, and people are definitely anticipating more tourism in the city. I think estimates are something like 50 million people are expected to visit in 2020, and the 2028 Olympics are going to just deluge the city with people.
And most important, is there now going to be a gondola from the LA Times building in downtown Los Angeles to your new campus in El Segundo?
You know, I'll be the first person in line to buy a ticket.
Ryan Fonder is an entertainment business reporter at the LA Times. Ryan, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, the Oregon Shakespeare Festival stages a gender-bending production of a Rodgers and Hammerstein classic. Heads up, this is not your grandfather's Oklahoma. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Last weekend, I headed up to Ashland. It's a small town in rural southern Oregon near the California border, and I went there for a concentrated dose of high-quality theater at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. In just 3 days, I saw four plays, including Shakespeare's Othello, but the festival doesn't just do the Bard. I also saw a new interpretation of the 1943 musical, Oklahoma. The casting of the Rodgers and Hammerstein classic is very different. Curly McLean is now played by a woman, and Ato Annie is now played by a man. And that makes the two romances at the heart of the musical same-sex love stories. Here's actress Tatiana Weschler as Curly singing the title song.
We know we belong to the land.
Oklahoma was directed by Bill Rausch. He is also the festival's artistic director. He was the co-founder of Cornerstone Theater Company, based here in Los Angeles. And when I sat down with Rausch in Ashland, he explained his personal connection to the musical.
I was in a production of Oklahoma as an elementary school kid. I was in a high school production. And then I was in another production when I was in high school. And I fell in love with the music and this idea of a story that was about community. And it was about, can we create a community that's accepting and loving? But I did not feel, as a gay kid, I did not feel my own story in there. And I began to fantasize about the possibility of changing the genders of some characters so that some of the heterosexual relationships could become gay relationships. It excited me. It felt right. It felt like a good way to honor the material. But I honestly felt I would never live to see it happen in my lifetime.
Because the Dramatists Guild protections, because the estate, what were the concerns?
The estate, the Rodgers and Hammerstein organization, has done a wonderful job protecting those authors' works, as is their job. And I just felt like there's no way they'll say yes to this. And even by some fluke, if they were to say yes, what theater would want to produce this version of Oklahoma? So it felt very like a personal fantasy project.
So when or how did fantasy become reality?
The most dramatic step toward it becoming reality is in the fall of 2015, I met with Ted Chapin, who runs Rodgers and Hammerstein, and I said, I just think we've looked at multiracial interpretations of classic musicals over the years, but we haven't looked at gender in this way. And I think it's time. And he believed in the possibility of the idea. And he brought it to some of the family members. And we got a yes.
And I think it's important to remember that some of the creators of the original show probably would be happy to see something like this. Lynn Riggs, who wrote the play Green Grow the Lilacs, which Oklahoma is based on, was a gay man. And the choreography and the producer of the original show were both women.
Absolutely. No, I have chosen to believe that those original creators are smiling down on this venture. Oklahoma was a big dose of optimism in trying to capture part of our country's spirit at a very stressful time in the middle of World War II. And I do feel that this inclusive version that we've done comes at a tumultuous time again in our country's history right now. And I do think the way audiences have just embraced it with such fervor and such kind of abandon of heart, you know, the audience has just so embraced it. I do think it has something to do with the times that we're living in.
Well, let's talk about the times that we're living in, because in the original libretto, as it is in your production, there's a scene around the time that Curly and Laurie are getting married. And Curly is talking about what she wants to do. And I'm quoting the libretto now. Bring up a pair of boys, new stock, to keep up with the way things are going in this here crazy country. And it's obviously two women who are saying this to each other, and it gets a reaction that is both a laugh and kind of a, you're right. And I'm wondering, when that scene or other scenes in the show are presented to audiences for the first time, were there unexpected reactions about how relevant something that seems so innocent might be today?
Absolutely. I love that you said it that moment. And in that same scene, Curly says, country a-changin', gotta change with it. And that inevitably gets applause and a cheer. I mean, it's first of all why we do classics, right? Here we are 75 years later from when those words were written, and they've got a similar and yet completely fresh resonance today. And this here crazy country, we're feeling it, right? We all feel the craziness of the experiment of this country right at this moment. And I feel like Rodgers and Hammerstein's optimistic portrait of a community where love and community triumph through this contemporary inclusive lens is striking a chord with people. One of my favorite responses to the piece has actually been from older audience members, usually older audience members, who say, I really thought of myself as very liberal, and it completely revealed to me my own biases because of the discomfort I had initially. And then by the end of the show, I realized, oh, wow. Those relationships are just like my relationship. And that's such an obvious truth, but I think people are experiencing it in such a visceral way.
We're talking with Bill Rausch. He is the artistic director of the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. Yesterday, I saw what I'll call a double bill, Othello and Oklahoma.
Oh my goodness.
The two things that you directed. And on the surface, they couldn't be more different. A play written 400 years ago by William Shakespeare, a musical that premiered in 1943. Where would you say their DNA is common?
I think that they both paint portraits of a society trying to navigate difference. In one case, through a tragic lens, and in the other case through a musical comedy lens. But I do think they're both about community and about navigating difference.
One of the things that you do in the staging of Othello, and this is not a spoiler if you've ever read Shakespeare, is that Othello at the end of the play kills Desdemona in her bed. And I've seen a number of productions of this play, and generally Othello smothers Desdemona with a pillow or something like that. You stage it as an act of domestic violence, and that seems obviously to be very intentional. Could you talk a little bit about that scene and how you approached it?
Well, it's an almost unwatchable play, I think, probably at any point in human history, certainly today, in terms of the misogyny, the racism, the xenophobia, the Islamophobia, that the play is just, that's what it explores. And there was no way, given the amount of misogyny that different characters traffic in, there was no way that that murder at the end of the play could be palatable, pretty, safe. It has to be as ugly as what it is.
And it also feels like, and this is where, you know, an audience member brings his or her own understanding of the world to a piece like Othello, that there is a very passionate speech that Emilia, Iago's wife, makes at the end of the play. And it almost feels like a Me Too moment, that she is saying, I'm not going to be silent. This is what happened. This is what this man did. And it's not right. And she's going to pay a penalty for talking about what has happened to a woman.
I completely agree with you. And, you know, it's this age-old question, right? Is Shakespeare anti-Semitic? Does Shakespeare expose anti-Semitism? Is Shakespeare racist? Does he expose racism? And, you know, the fact is Shakespeare was a white man living in a certain time and place. And he is, of course, a product of his cultural context. And he was an extraordinary artist who understood some of the great mysteries of the human heart and how societies function and dysfunction. And so I think it's absolutely right. You know, the fact that there were two boys playing those two women 400 years ago, and yet those eternal truths about how sexism operates in society ring with a renewed clarity 400 years later. But it's the same thing I think he was trying to do 400 years ago, I personally believe. You know, I think his humanity as a writer cuts through the societal limitations that he was writing within.
What do you think the role of theater or arts is in political conversation? Because about a year ago, Oscar Eustace's staging of Julius Caesar at the Public got a lot of attention because he depicted Julius Caesar as somebody who looked a little bit like the president. What kinds of things can theater do? What do you think it should be doing? How do you see your job and your theater company's role in all of that?
I think all art is political. I think all theater is political. You are naive if you say, I'm going to create this work of art and this is the political impact it's going to have on the world. That's naive. But I think it's even more naive and more dangerous if you don't recognize that whatever you do as an artist will have political impact. Because we all know we've been shaped by the art we consume. We are shaped daily by the art we consume. And especially young people, but all of us seeing both of these works of art, Othello and Oklahoma, it's going to shape how they interact with the rest of the world for the rest of their lives. You know, that's the responsibility you have as an artist.
Bill, thanks for coming on the show.
What a pleasure.
Bill Rausch's stagings of Oklahoma and Othello continue at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival in Ashland through the last weekend of October. Coming up, Armenian-American musicians explore new roads at the Smithsonian Folklife Festival. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. This show airs every weekday at 3:30 and again at 7 o'clock, but you can listen at your convenience by subscribing to our daily podcast, and that way you won't miss interviews like our recent chats with actress Tessa Thompson and director Boots Riley from the acclaimed movie Sorry to Bother You. You can get the frame from fine podcast providers such as Apple and Stitcher. And now, the Smithsonian Folklife Festival is held every summer on the National Mall in Washington, D.C., and each year there's a focus on a particular nation and its culture. At this year's 52nd annual festival, Armenia was one of the two featured countries. Armenian and Armenian-American artists participated in a celebration of their homeland's rich musical heritage, and several of them are putting a fresh spin on traditional Armenian music. The Frame contributor Beto Arkos attended the festival and has our story.
It's 90 degrees and very humid on a Friday afternoon at the National Mall in Washington. At the Smithsonian Folklife Festival, singer Samvel Galstian and his group perform a set of Armenian folk songs in a jazz setting. Galstian is an Armenian-American singer based in Boston. He says jazz has been a popular style in Armenia since the early 1950s. His new album features traditional Armenian songs from the 1940s to the 70s.
So these are very well-known songs in Armenia. So the Armenian music's element is in there. So even if I sing as a contemporary jazz, it's still there, the flavor of Armenian word and a music.
Armenians grew up with lots of different odd meters and syncopations, which coincides with jazz a lot.
Vardan Opsepian is an Armenian-American pianist based in Los Angeles. He says it may be surprising, but Armenian and American music have a lot in common.
Also the improvisational element too. As you heard some of the Armenian traditional music, it's not all rigid and written. There's lots of improvisation, so that aspect also is very similar to jazz.
So we have Hanina. Hanina is a song that for us represents sort of the essence of what folk music is. It's one that we like to share with our audience. We're hoping you'll sing it with us. Hanina, nina, nina, hanina, nina, nina, hanina, yesudu. Hanina, nina, nina, hanina, nina, nina, hanina, yesudu.
Also performing at the Smithsonian Folklife Festival is Zulal, a vocal trio of women who sing Armenian folk songs a cappella. Singers Teni Apelian, Geras Markarian, and Anais Tekerian are the three members of Zulal. Tekerian says when they met in New York City 15 years ago, they discovered all three had a cappella backgrounds.
Teni had a background in a cappella jazz, and Geras in more pop rock, and for me it was more Slavic, all college a cappella. And we came together and decided to put together a group, since we were all at least half, if not fully Armenian, put together a group and concentrate on Armenian music. And so definitely the arrangements that we create are very much informed by our backgrounds in a cappella, which is an American form, I guess.
Singer Teni Apelian says a cappella singing does not exist in Armenian folk music. She says harmony was introduced to Armenia by the renowned musician, composer, and ethnomusicologist known as Komitas at the turn of the 20th century.
The harmony that we bring is very much Western influenced, although there is a bit of Balkan influence coming from Anais's background. So it's a mix, but I think our presentation has that in mind, to move this music into an arena that it can be sort of digested by a wider audience.
The concept of interpreting Armenian folk songs with an American music style has also inspired a pop trio in Los Angeles. On a recent Tuesday afternoon at a restaurant in Little Armenia near Hollywood, guitarist Meher Ajamian talks about his group, Armenian Public Radio, and how they interpret traditional songs.
In a style that's more congruent with the country that we grew up here in the U.S. So a lot of Americana, blues, and folk, American folk influence in our music.
Ajamian, who is 37 years old, says one of the reasons they decided to interpret traditional songs stems from the trio's efforts to get more Armenians to listen to their own folk music.
None of our friends and our contemporary really actively listen to Armenian, traditional Armenian folk music, so we wanted to kind of make it more accessible to them.
From Boston to New York to Los Angeles, the common denominator among Armenian-American musicians is traditional music, says Anaïs Tekerian of the vocal trio Zulal.
The thing that ties us together is Armenian folk itself. Really, you can't meet an Armenian who doesn't know at least some of the, a good number, at least a dozen of the songs that just everyone knows. And so we all have that in common, so it's very easy for us to pull on that and to create our own version of Armenian folk jazz or Armenian folk a cappella or whatever. So I think that's what connects us, is that basic canon that we all have.
For The Frame, I'm Beto Arcos.
And that is our show for today. The Frame is back tomorrow. In the meantime, check us out on Instagram and Twitter. You will find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. Hunchumem yerken.